Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
And it's time for the Forgot My Dice podcast. In today's episode 0, we introduce you to the format of the show. We also talk to you about what we've had off the shelf. We cover the latest and greatest in news and crowdfunding. And we review Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition. All this and more on episode 0 of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Some grand tales of new dimensions in time and space.
And welcome to episode 0 of the Forgot My Dice podcast, the official podcast of ForgotMyDice.com. I'm Jonathan, your moderator, and to my left, Trevor.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Trevor, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am one of the co-writers of content on ForgotMyDice.com. I usually do exclusively 5th edition stuff, leaving most of the review work to Robert for now. I am a magic player, a D&D player, video gamer, voracious reader, and occasional commentator on all things pop culture.
You forgot billionaire philanthropist.
Billionaire philanthropist. Genius playboy.
And to my right, another panel member, Robert. Welcome to the show, Robert. How are you doing?
Hello, hello. I am the other writer on ForgotMyDice.com, and I also do a lot of reviews, which have been oddly popular lately. Although, shame on you people, we've gotten several Google hits from Delta Green Torrents. No, sir, you're not going to find that on our site.
Yeah.
Give Dennis money. He's a good guy.
All right. Well, let's kind of introduce the show a little bit. And we'll start out by letting you know that this is, of course, episode zero. And the reason it's episode zero is because we're still kind of ironing out the concept of the show and what it's going to entail. Mainly, this is going to be an opportunity for us to expand the content from ForgotMyDice.com and kind of explore a lot of the concepts that you're seeing on the site, except in a lot more detail. And we've got some ideas in terms of frequency and content. So let's kind of go through those. So number one on the list is we're going to be a bi-weekly podcast.
Yep, that means every other week.
And with insights like that, I mean, you'll be sure to tune in. So in terms of what the podcast will entail, let's kind of go through some of the content that folks can come to expect from us. Again, the thing to consider is that this is an episode zero, which means that we're still ironing out the concept. Things are going to change a lot. Now,
be sure to leave us feedback. We have Facebook comments enabled on ForgotMyDice.com, so you can leave a comment if you're logged into your Facebook account. Very easy. You can also reach us on Twitter at ForgotMyDice. And you can also go to our Facebook page and just send us a message. We read everything.
Pinterest, actually. I have been active on Pinterest.
Oh,
I've been figuring that out.
Robert has been looking up ways to make wonderful bookends out of your old coat hangers.
Robert has already admitted to us that he's incapable of functioning on BoardGameGeek, but
yes,
completely functional on the Pinterest.
I can't tell you how long it took me to figure out how to join a guild.
Maybe by the time that you hear this, we will have set up a BoardGameGeek guild, so yes. Keep an eye out for that.
So I think the point of the whole thing is there's a variety of different ways that you can get a hold of us and leave us any kind of feedback that you want. Mostly what we're looking for here is let us know what you think of the concept. Let us know what you think of the segments that we're offering. And just any kind of feedback is good feedback as we kind of grow through these first couple three episodes. And to that end, let's talk a little bit about release schedule, because we are going to have a little bit of a lull until we get to our initial release schedule. So if you're listening to this episode, this episode's releasing in early July, probably July 1st or whereabouts. And that's going to be basically our statement about what we're going to be doing and what we're looking at. And kind of the structure of the show and what to expect when we start releasing on a regular basis in September. So expect the Forgot My Dice podcast to really take off in September. And at that point, we are going to enter into that bi-weekly schedule. And we've got a lot of fun stuff planned. So to that, let's talk about some of the things that people can kind of expect from the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Well, the podcast is going to be an expansion of the content we already do on the site. So far, our site has been limited to 5th edition D&D original content, so our homebrew, basically, new classes, races, monsters, etc. And Robert has been writing some excellent reviews, but we're going to be expanding out a little bit to cover other games that we're all interested in. As I mentioned before, I'm interested in Magic the Gathering.
I play a fair amount of War Machine.
Rob does play a lot of War Machine.
Yes, you've got me addicted to that crack now too.
No, you haven't. You played once,
and of course, we're bringing in Jonathan for his extensive knowledge of the board gaming scene. Because while Robert and I both dabble in board games, it is not our main focus. So,
although curse you for getting me to play Camel Up, I have not been able to buy that game, and it's been driving me insane slowly.
Yeah, it's huge right now. It's sold out everywhere I can look.
But basically, between the three of us, you essentially have a fully functional nerd Voltron that, that covers the three pillars of the community. We've got card flipping, we've got dice rolling, we've got meeple placing. It's all here.
So let's talk about something else that you can come to expect. So Forgot My Dice has been running about 8 months now, and one thing that folks have kind of come to expect is that monthly theme.
Yes.
So to that end, we're going to kind of try and, you know, hook that theme into the overarching direction of the podcast as well, among the other topics that we're going to be covering. So kind of keep that in mind. And so let's talk a little bit about the theme for July.
So our theme for July is going to be Cartilaginous Elasmobranch Ocean Predator Month, which, as you may or may not know, cartilaginous elasmobranch ocean predators include things called sharks.
Right. Sharks.
And a month is a unit of time.
Right.
You could almost call it 4 to 5 weeks.
Right.
Right. Right.
About sharks.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. So anyway, so we're going to be writing a lot about sharks.
But we wouldn't ever want to put those two words together in a sentence.
Especially in a particular month of the year might be copyrighted for reasons. So,
because we wouldn't, you know.
We would never infringe on anybody's copyright with anything we do.
Also, there was a lot of talk about, what was it, street sharks with
awesome.
Yeah, with some article ideas. So
you can expect articles about the deep sea sharks and their interesting qualities. So we're going to try to bring some of that out in the D&D way. You know, we're going to have things with gills, things with teeth, things with, you know, like armored hide, and for the D&D side of it. And then we can also talk about, you know, like on the podcast and things, we can talk about movies with sharks in them and other kind of pop
Escape
culture.
From Atlantis, meeples get eaten by sharks.
That's a good one.
So just kind of wrap up the intro here. We won't always do an intro quite like this. This is definitely a unique thing for episode zero. But keep in mind, we'll be bi-weekly starting in September. We're going to have a lot of great different segments in the show. We're going to include stuff like Off the Shelf, which is where we talk about the different things that we've managed to get to the table, primarily games and RPGs, of course, but we'll also talk a little bit about the other wonderful geeky things that we're into. We're going to have a news segment where we talk about some of the ongoing board game and RPG news, which these days there is just a ton of. I mean, with the way the industry is going, there's just so much.
We're kind of, well, I mean, I guess there's news now. Like on the storefront, there's not a lot right now because everybody's just like holding all their stuff for Gen Con.
Yeah. We're also going to have a great crowdfunding section where we're going to talk about a lot of the crowdfunding projects that are hitting the market. We're going to have a lot of designer interviews with folks that are creating these crowdfunding projects. We're also going to have designer interviews with folks from mainstream gaming. We're also going to feature a review every episode. We're going to be going back and forth between board game reviews and RPG reviews, depending on which episode it is. So, being bi-weekly, you'll get roughly 2 episodes a month, and you'll get a little bit of each flavor, so to speak. Robert, what do you like to kind of bring into your RPG reviews?
Well, for the site, I write them from the point of view of somebody who has played 5th edition, because that's kind of what I assume the knowledge base is, so that's usually what I bring it back to. For this, I mean, the sky's the limit. Like, we can talk about anything we want. I have no idea what if that answered your question or not.
I mean, what I think it's important to do in a review is, you know, we just give you guys a good perspective on what type of product it is, who the target audience is, and, you know, let you make good purchasing decisions to fit your taste.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is such a subjective market, like, it's very difficult to say, like, something is definitely a must-buy for everybody, because not everybody likes the same stuff. So we're just going to talk about the qualities that things possess that make them interesting, and then you can decide for yourself.
Yeah, and Trevor, I think you really bring a good point up when you call it subjective, because, you know, designing a board game or an RPG system really is it's an art form, just like any other art form, and you're going to have people that absolutely adore one thing and despise the next, mm-hmm. and that's absolutely okay. We're not planning on giving, like, scores or shit.
Yeah, one of the things you'll notice, Robert does not give scores on his reviews.
I believe in the Kotaku review scale of just say, this is cool.
Yeah.
And here's why it's cool. And if you don't think that's cool, then you probably should not get it.
Yeah. And you know what? If we don't agree with things, you might find a differing opinion between just the three of us sometimes based on personal likes and dislikes. So what I would suggest is as you get to know us and get to know our personalities, you'll probably find that your taste lines up with one, if not two, maybe even all three of us. And you'll start to find very quickly whose opinion kind of will steer you to your likes and dislikes in any particular title. So keep that in mind. You know, that it's not about whether it's good or not. We're just going to let you know all about it, and it's up to you to decide whether it's good or not.
Yeah, well, and one of the things is that we tend not to review products that we don't think are at least pretty darn good. Like, if we're reviewing something, it's probably already has some acclaim and some market share that says, okay, this is a quality product.
Well, also, we got to spend the time to actually do it because, you know, getting a review ready, I mean, even a written review for the site, it takes a while and it's effort.
And honestly, the same is going to go for board games too, because to be able to discuss a board game and to be able to discuss mechanics, you really have to kind of test them out a couple times. And you're never going to get the full flavor of a board game the first time because you're figuring out the rules, you're figuring out what works, what doesn't, you don't have any kind of strategy to apply to it. Really, you kind of get that on the fifth or sixth try. So we'll be making sure that when we bring you a board game review, it'll be the same thing. It's going to have a lot of mileage under it before we start talking about it so that we can speak from a position of knowledge. And now it's time for us to head into our off-the-shelf section. So in this particular segment, we're going to be talking about all the wonderful things that we've had an opportunity to play. Trevor, let's go start with you. What have you had an opportunity to get out on the table?
Well, I haven't been doing as much tabletop gaming. I've been doing a little bit of Magic. You know, Eternal Masters just dropped. I haven't had an opportunity to draft it tabletop myself, but I've organized and run a couple of drafts at the shop and played it online. It's a lot of fun. Role-playing wise, we're still doing Knights Black Agents with Rob.
Good times.
Yeah. My
now you guys are working on the Dracula dossier.
Dracula dossier, yeah. My Indian special effects artist / demo man got to dismember the vampire who bit him and punch her head off of a shrimp boat, which was kind of awesome. Yeah, that happened. Also, War Machine Mark III dropped. I am not a particularly strong War Machine player. The game is too much physical labor for my taste. I like my strategy games compact and portable, but I love theory crafting it. So I've been reading the cards furiously and like looking over the rules changes and talking to Robert about the rules changes.
Yep.
And laughing at Crick's player tears and things like that.
They're delicious. Yeah.
And then of course I've actually this month's theme on Forgot My Dice has been pretty challenging, so I've actually been busting out my D&D books again and like really like digging deep into the rules to make sure that I'm not like treading old territory again. So that's, you know.
Yeah, the Monsters as Player Characters article, like, yeah, you put some effort into that one.
Yeah, that one was hard. Like, it was very difficult to work out how to properly balance them. And I'd seen other people do it on the internet, like, that had, like, tried to do their own rules for making monster player characters, and, like, it was so much, like, ad hoc stuff, and I was like, there needs to just be a simple way to, like, strip it down and make one rule to do this correctly. So that's what I tried to do. I don't know how successful I was, but you can check the article out on forgotmydice.com. It's called Here You Be Monsters.
Yes.
And for folks who might not be familiar, let's give a little bit of context. So when we talk about Mark III, we're talking about the new rule set for War Machines and Hordes.
Yeah, it's not officially called Mark III because they're doing that D&D thing where they're like, there's no new edition, it's just the edition, and you can call it what you want. It's the third iteration, we're calling it Mark
All
III. All New War is, I guess, its official name.
That's like its tagline.
Yeah, that's the hashtag. Hashtag All New War.
Now, Robert, I think you're the reason that the two of us even know what War Machines is at this point, yeah?
Yeah. It started just from not wanting to play Games Workshop anymore, and I started poking around, and I just sort of landed on it. It was weird. And then when we opened up our shop, just randomly, the War Machine players decided that we were kin and started coming there. So I actually got to play, because I had a whole bunch of models that I never got to play, and then they all came to my shop, and I'm like, cool, I will play a lot. And I have.
And you've actually got me hooked on it, too, now. What about you, Robert? What have you had a chance to have on the table?
Well, I've been doing Knights Black Agents with Trevor, and I'm running it, which is interesting. Sadly, the podcast I've been listening to has run out of steam, so that was a really good source of inspiration. It was the Mythgard Academy. They were dissecting Dracula, and it was great. Like, it just filled your head full of nonsense. That was a lot of fun. The other thing I've been digging into lately, besides War Machine Mark III, Wizards, about a month ago now, when Plane Shift Zendikar came out?
I think it was before Shadows Over Innistrad dropped, actually, so that was a couple months ago.
Yeah. Well, they dropped this PDF that was actually, they drop a lot of PDFs. They're usually like 2-3 pages. This one was like, what was it, 50 or 30, 36, something like that.
It was in the 30s, yeah.
Yeah, it was a good amount of stuff, and it just converted, it basically, the idea is they released an art book for the Zendikar block, which was the last block of Magic cards. And it had the art from the previous one, too. So there's 5 sets of Magic cards art in one book. And it was just, talking about the lore and all the stuff in it. And then what they did with that was they took that and then made 36 pages of D&D rules to go with it. And so it's like, use the art book as a campaign setting. And I'm like, Wizards, like, how has this taken 19 years for you guys to do? Seriously.
That is actually a really good point.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they're essentially taking the Magic of the Gathering world,
right,
and dropping it into the D&D rule set, which makes so much sense.
Yeah, it's like
dumb chocolate in your peanut butter. It's like, why did it take so long for someone to figure that out?
Yeah. And I know they've had plans to do it for years, and just one group or another gets, doesn't want to do it. But this was like really good, and it actually got me reading Zendikar lore, which I fiddle with Magic occasionally. Like, I got really into the first Innistrad block because I'm all like, yes, humans hunt vampires. Urgh. But
Rob likes killing vampires.
I do like killing vampires. So I hadn't really read Zendikar, and I'm reading this book, and the book's amazing. And it's weird. It's weird from like a Magic perspective, like what they really pay attention to versus what you would pay attention to in a D&D perspective, because like maps and, kind of the big picture stuff of like, this is what you would use to adventure, they kind of gloss over in Magic World because they don't do that. But they like the visuals and like the art styles and everything that makes you feel something about the campaign setting, they get like down, and they can like talk at length about it, and they do in these books, and it's amazing to read. I actually pre-ordered the Innistrad art books up next, and I'm like, oh, Wizards, please give me 36 pages of Innistrad, because that would be awesome. And then the Kaladesh one's up next, too.
I just as an addendum to that, they actually already kind of snuck in some Innistrad stuff for D&D in the last Unearthed Arcana, because they released it as part of their tie-in to Curse of Strahd. They released an Inquisitive Rogue Path,
okay,
which ties directly into the Investigate mechanic from the new Shadows of Innistrad.
I did not put that together.
Yeah, and it has like a lot of investigative stuff, and they also they threw in a couple of other like kind of gothic horror references, which can go with Ravenloft, obviously, which is a tried and true classic D&D setting.
Yes.
Or they can go with Innistrad, which is the gothic horror Magic setting. So
yeah. So like I said, Wizards, if you're listening, release that PDF. I bought the art book. I would like to use it for something.
He doesn't even play Magic.
I don't even play Magic, and I will buy I've been looking at this art for Kaladesh, which is the set coming out after it. And it's amazing because it's this weird, like,
it's like steampunk India.
Yeah. Or more like magic punk India, because there's not steam. It's more like, because like they show these like horses and they're like these weird sculptures.
It's very clockwork.
Yeah.
They have the thopters.
Yeah. Very thoptery. Yeah. And I was like, that would be, I mean, I guess it's kind of treading the same ground as Eberron, but it's kind of got a very different vibe, which I like.
It's the first time anyone's really tackled fantasy India in a Western game.
Yeah, that too.
It's never really been done, so.
Well, I've had a chance to get some gaming in as well.
I noticed. Like, your list is longer than ours combined.
Just as an aside for the people listening at home, like, Rob and I have these, like 4 little bullet
points. And we, like, stressed. We stressed.
Jonathan's got, like, 12 here, I think. So we'll let him...
Shotgun it, man.
I've had a unique kind of couple weeks. So I got a chance to play the Dresden Files cooperative card game.
Awesome.
And it was phenomenal. Eric Vogel is the guy who did it. He also did a great game called Zeppelin's Attack, which is a deck builder with a very different twist on deck building, which I really liked. And he also did a game called Don't Turn Your Back, which is this weird, super dark deck builder.
It's based on that RPG, Don't Rest Your Head.
Oh, I love Don't Rest Your Head.
Okay, so it's the same basic world and the same graphic design, and it's all in deck building form.
Well, yeah. So Don't Rest Your Head is this really weird conceptual RPG where essentially the reality that we live in is just as much as the reality that we dream is a reflection of the other. And so people that are conscious of the reality of the dream world can, like, kind of maintain it. But the problem is that once you're aware of the dream world's aware of you. So if you go to sleep unprotected in our world, bad things can happen to you, hence the name Don't Rest Your Head.
And all of those concepts come forth in this card game. It's really, it's one of the more interesting deck builders I've had a chance to play, and I love deck builders. So it was, getting back to Dresden, I mean, Dresden was really well put together. It's a neat game, and it's kind of interesting because I'm a big fan of the Dresden Files books, and it really captures the theme very effectively, which is so hard to do. I've had a chance to play a lot of Star Realms recently. It's just so quick and easy to get out, you know? You take out your Star Realms deck, you spend 60 seconds setting it up, and you can get a game done in 10 minutes.
Yeah, I own it. I play it with Gina occasionally.
Star Realms is phenomenal. I actually ended up picking up a copy of Cthulhu Realms, which is the Star Realms engine, but with a Cthulhu paint job.
With the obligatory Cthulhu theme.
Yes. Except that it's this weird kind of kooky Cthulhu theme, where it's very tongue-in-cheek, and it's kind of like a send-up of the whole Cthulhu mythos.
Oh my god, Cthulhu is over. We're at the point of self-parody.
Yes. Yeah. And it's, I don't know, I find it to be very charming from a balance perspective. I actually think that it's a better balanced game than Star Realms. Hmm. Star Realms has a tendency to get real streaky.
Yeah.
And you'll have a score where one person's only lost 8 points at the end of the game, and the other person is completely decimated. This tends to balance out a lot better and keep the scores relatively close to one another. So they've made some kind of really smart decisions in the card design. I had a chance to play D&D 5th with a small group, just a little one-off. And it was kind of nice being a player for once, because I've only ever run 5th edition games. I started reading a new RPG system called Fantagi. Fantagi.
Yeah.
It's available on DriveThruRPG. It's doing some interesting stuff with concepts. So you have a variety of keywords that come up as a scene is described, right?
Yeah.
So like the trial that I had of it, all the players were standing in a field of razor grass. And so you write razor grass on a 3x5 card and put that down on the table. And you're fighting this griffin. And the griffin comes with a bunch of different keywords because it's a pre-established enemy.
Yeah.
And those keywords are basically akin to its powers and the things that it does. And they can be emotional effects like terror and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then your character has effects like that. Like my character had something called calm like a bomb. So you have all these different concepts that are getting placed down on the table. And when the player does an action, they basically start to role play and they have to try and key in all the different themes and that are on the cards and the themes that are in the enemy and the themes that are happening. And anytime something happens, right, like we cut the griffin's tail off, so it started spurting blood everywhere. So blood became a keyword that then gets placed on the table. And the players are basically trying to hit as many of these themes as possible, because by hitting them, you're adding dice to your dice pool. And the GM is basically looking through and determining, okay, you hit this, you hit that, you hit this, you hit that, so you can add 6 dice to your base dice pool. And it's a bunch of D10s, you roll them out, and whatever number is the highest between you and the roll of the GM becomes like a success or a failure, and however many of those you have determines how successful or how much of a failure you were.
Hmm.
It's a neat system. I've never played anything quite like it before. The universe that they've offered you in the core book is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon meets decidedly anime flavor.
Mm-hmm. So very much like Wuja is the genre that a lot of people kind of find that as.
But that's just one of the worlds that they provide. They have a sci-fi world that I haven't tried yet. And the core system, it's kind of neat because it's very narrative and because it's very player driven in terms of describing what's happening. You could really just kind of generally apply it to anything.
Hmm.
So, Fantagi, it's a really neat system. It's actually local here to the Austin area. The gentleman lives here in Austin. And then I also finally got a chance to start my Pandemic Legacy campaign.
Jeez.
Yeah.
You've been doing everything.
Well, you squeeze it in when you can. And we were actually able to beat the first 2 months of Pandemic. And the Legacy stuff is really neat. It's such a great
concept. Briefly go into the Legacy stuff? Because that's actually what I'm most curious about. I played a lot of Pandemic.
I played a lot of Pandemic too, but yeah, I've never played the Legacy Edition. I'm wondering maybe they kind of like tone down the first couple of missions and then ramp it up.
You know, you'd think that, except no. It is Pandemic. Like, we had a catastrophic, near-fatal...
Outbreak
that, yeah. You know, tumbled to other cities. And
yeah.
When we did our random draw at first, the three cities that had the three cubes to start with were all right next to each other. It was
nice.
The worst draw ever. You also have fewer rolls when you start.
Oh, you so earn those over time.
You don't have the flexibility of bringing in some of those other rolls. You have you have a very select few rolls when you first start. Now, here's where it gets interesting. In the first mission, and because it's the first mission, I'm not too worried about spoilers, but if you are worried about a spoiler, go ahead and fast forward. But in the first mission, on your second outbreak, there's a little reminder marker that you place down on the thing, and you open up a pack of cards, and you start to deal cards based on you hitting this milestone. And those cards begin to have immediate effects on the game. They're completely gameplay-changing effects. And one of the viruses becomes uncurable. You cannot cure it. Which means your objective of curing all four diseases is now trashed, and you pick up this card and you physically rip it in half. It tells you to tear it in half, which for me as a board game connoisseur, I'm just sitting there watching the guy tear the card in half, and I'm like going into a minor convulsion, just like, stop, no. But yeah, you tear the card in half, and then you put down a brand new objective that comes out of this package. And then as you progress, there's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure aspect. Based on your performance, you get told to go to specific peel-offs. And you go through this sheet of a huge number of letters and numbered peel-offs. And you start peeling them off to reveal the changes to mm-hmm. the overall game. Sometimes they're positive. We managed to eradicate one of the diseases. And so one of our peel-offs was, hey, now this one, you no longer have to be at a research station to cure this. You can cure it anywhere.
Oh, wow.
So that, I mean, that... Because we eradicated that disease, suddenly we have this huge leg up on that disease. And that is a sticker that gets placed on the game board and is now a permanent status change for the remainder of your Pandemic Legacy campaign.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds very similar to some things that existed in Risk Legacy, too. And
yeah,
it's very similar.
It's the same design team.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the designer of Pandemic mixed with the Legacy designer from Risk
from
Legacy.
From Risk, yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's neat. Everybody's game board is going to be different too, which is really neat because we've already had several outbreaks, and whenever there's an outbreak, you basically put a sticker next to that city, letting it know as additional outbreaks happen in the same city. That city slowly, basically tumbles from being a calm, happy, healthy place into anarchy. And if you have a research station there and it goes into riots, the research station gets destroyed, and yeah, it's really interesting because by the end of the first game, your board will be completely unique to your group.
That's neat.
I like that.
Cool. Oh, and I heard that Robert also got you into War Machine, and you picked my previous faction.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I've officially dug in. Robert very slowly and gently slid the needle in.
Yeah. I just tweeted you pictures.
Yeah, he. We sat down, we played one game, and about a third of the way through the game, I realized that not only am I completely into that style of game, but I like the steampunk, I like the models, I like the fact that there's two distinct games that essentially are completely compatible with one another.
Yeah, the Hordes on the War Machine.
Yeah, it's more like there's two distinct resource mechanics
that you can
choose
yeah,
from.
Yeah, because, I mean, I guess from a core mechanic perspective, the core mechanics are essentially balancing each other out, but they're being called different things. But it's a neat idea.
Mm-hmm,
and yeah. I like that the fact that the two factions, you know, one's more naturalistic, and then you've got the Mankind faction, which is bringing in all the mechs and the
Yeah, we played Signar versus Trollbloods.
Right on.
For our game.
It was when you started telling me all about the lore and how deep it went and how, and this is one of my favorite things about it, how as the system has progressed and new models have come out and new marks of the rule systems and the role-playing and everything is in a constant state of evolution, and there's a narrative that started long ago, and the narrative continues, and people rise to power and fall, and people lose weapons and arms and all kinds of stuff, and that's all represented in the models. And
the Witchfire trilogy, the main bad gal, I
antagonist.
Guess. Antagonist. That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. The main antagonist is a lady named Alexia Sianor, I think is her last name. And she's a model in War Machine. You can play her. She's actually got two different versions of her. One of her is on horseback, and she makes super zombies. And the other one, she has just a massive amount of zombies that are wearing both Kadoran and Signar stuff. And then she can churn some of those into those super zombies. But yeah, it's all tied into each other. It's really cool.
Well, and then when the Undercity came out, I bought that.
Yeah, the Widower's Wood.
And well, no, the under.
Oh yeah, the original.
Undercity Privateer also makes board games. Not a lot of people know that they have the Level 7 series, but Undercity is their dungeon crawler.
Yeah.
Basically, it's their version of like Descent or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's fully cooperative, which I really appreciate. You're fighting against a deck-driven AI, which is really neat because then you don't have to have that one person that's kind of odd man out and running the game.
Yeah, it actually has like a really interesting targeting priority system that I like, where it has very specific rules of like, okay, this is who the enemies are going to attack. Yeah. Which the players then get to kind of integrate into their strategy a little bit. It's like, okay, we know that these type of enemies prioritize their targets like this. Let's set ourselves up to make it most advantageous so that they hit our Warjack first and don't kill us.
The part that I was super proud of was I gave him Victor Pendrake as part of his Signar army. And he recognized the figure from the Widower's Wood. He's like, is that guy? I'm like, yes, it is. Like, see, there you go.
I'm buying into the fluff like crazy. It's great fluff.
Yeah.
So that's about it from a gaming perspective. What about other little pieces of geeky goodness?
Overwatch.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
oh my gosh.
I've been playing a lot of Overwatch.
Winston's my jam right now.
I love Zarya. In Russia, game plays you.
You know what? You know what's really irritating about Zarya? There are so many terrible Zarya players out there. And then you run into the one that actually knows what they're doing, and she is the most frustrating thing in the world.
I pretty much only play her on control point maps, because I find that she's probably the most flexible offensive tank. She's the offensive tank that most easily transitions into a defensive role.
Yeah.
So that's why I play her. I really like playing her on Hollywood. On Hollywood, she is so good, and like people don't even know. I have wrecked people on Hollywood with Zarya.
Robert, you bring up a really good point. I would call her one of the hardest to play characters. You really have to have a certain level of mastery with her as an individual character, because most players that I see, like I see a Zarya come around the corner, and I'm like, all first catch of the day.
What a lot of people may not realize is Zarya's mechanics are actually very similar to some League of Legends characters. So if you're a MOBA player and you're familiar with how to time spell shields from a game like League of Legends, she is fairly intuitive to play, because you kind of have that idea of learning to time your shields for enemy is about to do the bad thing, hit the shield.
Yeah.
But the problem is that if you're mostly an FPS gamer, that instinct isn't there. But I love her because I tend to play support characters in MOBAs and MMOs and stuff like that. And she's one of the only support tank. She's the only support tank in the game. So I really dig her. Anyway, that was a long tangent about Zarya. Point is, Overwatch is freaking awesome.
Overwatch is freaking awesome.
It's really well designed. It's really well.
Well, like what Kotaku said, it's not a video game. It's a meme, cosplay, and fan art generator.
Well, the world's great. The character designs are great.
And it's Blizzard, because I've got some problems with the initial balance of a few of the characters, but I'm not worried because it's a Blizzard game.
They've already addressed it.
Well,
they already nerfed
and they will
Widow
continue
McCree,
to.
You know.
Yeah, Widow was out of control on launch.
On the PC. On the console version, she was not as bad, but with the PC,
the controller input kind of like leveled the playing field.
Yeah, but on PC, Widowmaker was gross.
Widowmaker was, believe it or not, worse on PC.
Oh no, I fully
yeah know. Yeah no I've seen videos. I'm like, whoa, that's not cool.
Yeah, well no, I was telling Rob, like Rob was like, why are they nerfing her again? And I'm like, well, you'd see your kill cam and you would just see Widow shoot you three times in the body and like not even have to aim at your head.
Yeah,
and you would die. Anyway, in addition to Overwatch, I have a little video game thing I want to throw out. I've been playing the early access of Master of Orion, and there's another 4X game, Stellaris, which is getting a lot of press right now. So if you're a 4X gamer and you like the sci-fi things, both of those games are definitely worth checking out. I just have to throw a shout out to Master of Orion, because I loved the Master of Orion series all the way back to the 90s when it first came out. And I actually really like that sci-fi universe, and it's one of my pet projects is to try to do an RPG conversion of that universe.
Nice.
So you may, if I can ever like get a hold of somebody at wargames.net now, because the licenses bounce between like five people at this point, because first Meraxes had it, then Atari had it forever, and then Atari got dissolved, and then someone else bought it, and then anyway, but the point is, if I never get a hold of somebody and be like, hey, can I maybe write a Master of Orion role-playing game, you might, you know, I don't know.
How about you, Robert? Any other little bits of geeky goodness?
No. I've been playing so much Overwatch. Like, I have been playing so much Overwatch. Well, I mean, like, you know, Agents of Shield.
Pale.
Yeah. Well, Agents of Shield is done for the and Flash. Like, I was kind of my geeky goodness.
We,
but
we are in that kind of lull for TV. Yeah. You know, there's no TV going on.
Well, Game of Thrones is going on, but both Robert and I are like not like huge into Game of Thrones. I don't know about you, but
I watch it every week. But yeah. I mean,
I'm in that weird loop where I don't want to read the books because it's really hard for me to get past a fourth book if the series isn't done.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to read the books, but I don't want to watch the TV show because I don't want to spoil the books.
Really, the first two seasons follow the books pretty closely, and then there's some major deviations.
Yeah.
And you know what? Honestly, they're both better for it because, like any good adaptation, they're doing a really good job of picking and choosing what works for the screen. And not trying to do the things that you would need that 100 pages of internal exposition from a character.
Yeah, well, and now in season 6, now that they're doing stuff that hasn't been covered by the books at all,
yeah.
I was telling Rob, it's basically like the best fanfic you'll ever watch.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, no like, kidding.
It's
the episode that aired last night with no spoilers, it has a very large battle scene, and it is probably, I mean, it's like motion picture quality battle scene in a TV show. And it was one of the most intense and well-shot sequences I've ever seen.
Nice.
It was remarkable. It's worth it just to get to that point. Because there's some really genuinely good scenes. And then every so often you have that really weird one-off effect shot that is just crap. And it just doesn't work.
Yeah, sometimes the dragons do not look good.
Like, 9 times out of 10, they look amazing. Like, I'm sitting there watching this show and I'm like, I can't believe I'm watching a TV show. Like, we've gotten to that point where TV shows can look like movies. And then you get to that one where it's like they ran out of budget and so they called the discount effects mill up and they're like, look, we're going to send you this 3D render, but we know that your computers can't handle it, so go ahead and derez it and don't worry about green screening. We'll just kind of cut and paste and I'm sure it'll work out fine. here's $25 because that's all I got left in my budget.
Someone's a technical nerd in case you can't tell.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I've managed a little bit of geek. Finally managed to finish the second Dresden novel. I'm rereading all of them again for the, I don't know, umpteenth time.
Yet another series I didn't make it through. I got to the fourth one.
Oh, Dresden's worth the investment. They're really
it's
good.
It's not over.
It's so
much
fun.
I got a mental roadblock. It happens to me all the time.
I reread Man in the High Castle for the, I don't know, 90th or 100th time because I really, really like Philip K. Dick.
Are you watching the show of that?
Well, that's what made me reread it. I watched the show and I wanted to get fresh on the book to kind of get a sense for the deviations. And there, again, another really good example of an adaptation that takes the really good parts of the book and goes its own direction with it and adapts it for the screen and what works for the screen. And I was really impressed by that. They did such a fine job while retaining the spirit of the book. After I read Man in the High Castle, I'd heard about this book called United States of Japan, which is supposed to be like the spiritual successor to Man in the High Castle. So I read it, and I don't know, it's a great story with kind of like a upper mediocre writer that sometimes does a really, really good job, and sometimes he gets a little too anime, I guess I would say. So you get kind of a mixed bag, but the book itself is really just, it's very readable. I mean, I tore through it in like less than a week. It's a very easy read.
Yeah. And I hear there's giant robots in it too.
There are giant robots. There's mecha, and that's where it starts to get really anime. which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, like, I love giant mecha, but it's just kind of a, for every moment that it spends being a really good observation of how Philip K. Dick would construct his worlds, it also spends a minute going bubblegum pulp anime. And, you know, that's just not my personal speed, but I can see why the book has done well, because I know a lot of people would be interested in that. And, but which is not to say the book wasn't enjoyable, because I did enjoy it. I read it straight through.
While we're having book club, I'm actually reading a superhero novel right now, which I need to get around to finishing. I'm about halfway through it. It's called After the Golden Age. But it's a very interesting take. It's written from the perspective of the daughter of, essentially, it's like, it's kind of got like an Incredibles or Fantastic Four sort of vibe. Like, basically her parents both have superpowers and got married, and they are the premier super team. Like, it's her mom, her dad, and their two sidekicks, basically. And she was raised, you know, in a superhero house, but she herself has no powers. She is an ordinary person. And she becomes an accountant, of all things. But it's kind of interesting. Like, the book, like, kicks off with her getting kidnapped, and she's, like, just totally blasé about the whole thing. She's like, dude, this is, like, the 14th time this has happened. My parents are going to bust down a wall and, like, mess you up. Like, just don't even bother. But what's really interesting about it is that her relationship with her parents is actually, like, really bad. Like, her dad's, like, kind of an abusive jerk. And, like, her mom is, like really, like kind of distant. And they have a weird relationship because they just don't know how to relate to her because they're gods and she's not.
It's actually a really interesting idea.
Yeah, it's a strange little book. The writing style is not the greatest. Like, I mean, it's very like just kind of matter of fact, like, you know, narrative. Like, there's not a lot of flowery language to it or anything, but the characters are interesting, so I'm enjoying it.
And then the last little bit of geeky stuff I did, I had a chance to finally watch Chappie, which I know I'm like 2 years late to the show on that one.
But I still haven't seen it.
I still haven't seen it.
You know what? I really, really, really like him as a director. What the
Neil Blomkamp?
Yeah, Neil Blomkamp.
Blomkamp?
Yeah. I like him as a director. And man, he can make $48 million look like $200 million. Like, the guy really knows how to put together an effects movie, which makes me really excited that he's working on Aliens. But that's neither here nor there.
So how was the reboot of Short Circuit?
that was what I saw, got from the trailer, is Short Circuit with D-Antwoord in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's just get the D-Antwoord part out of the way. That was a huge mistake. I know where they were going with it. I get it. They were trying to, you know, get that certain vibe. I feel like there's actors that could have totally gotten that vibe, but they would have actually been good actors and been able to deliver dialogue with sincerity and not, you know, like a wooden cutout.
Yeah.
But aside from that, the scenes with Chappie himself, who's played by Charlton Copley, are amazing. He does such a good job. There are very distinct stages that the Chappie character goes through. You know, being a very young child to kind of being the inquisitive why, you know, kind of mid-child, to the impetuous teenager that's just trying to impress his dad. And it goes through this natural evolution in a very rapid form because it's this AI. And there's some genuinely heart-wrenching scenes. Like, the violence that happens to the robot is surprisingly effective. Like, you're not supposed to care. It's a robot. He can swap out, you know, a part in a heartbeat. And yet you're sitting there and like, why are they doing this to this poor creature, you know? It's a real testament to how effective the acting is to draw you in. Unfortunately, it's a mixed bag because of the Diane word part, but it also has a very fluffy ending, you know, without going into any detail. It's like you've got this rugged landscape and this rugged story and this a lot of good questions being asked by the movie, and then it's like, oh, hold on, we've made you think too hard. Here's a nice pillow so that you can gently land from the high that you're on.
Yeah, that was actually, that's been my problem with a lot of movies, actually, is, like, lately it seems like a lot of, like, kind of deep and hard-hitting sci-fi films kind of fall apart in the third act.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they lose, they basically chicken out.
And now it's time to head into the news segment. And in this news segment, we're going to be giving you a little preview, just a couple stories this time. The first story that came to mind that I saw that's kind of pertinent for the news right now is that IDW is creating a preferred retailer program.
Yeah, this is something basically to give an edge to brick-and-mortar stores over the internet. We've all had the conversations about how tough it is for retailers right now with competing with the internet, and this encourages them to run demos and provide some play space for people to check out IDW's game lines, which, Jonathan, remind us what all they make.
IDW's had X-Files.
X-Files.
They've had the Back to the Future board game. Well, it's the Back to the Future adventure card game, Adventure Through Time. They were the U.S. publisher for a Spiel des Jahres winner called The Game, which is a phenomenal card game. They of course, had the most recent, very successful Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Kickstarter.
Right, and they also published the comic book for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles currently. Yes. With the original writer, Eastman.
Kevin Eastman.
He's working on it still, so.
IDW is definitely expanding their board game business. It's definitely, you can tell by the things that they've been releasing and properties that they've announced so far that it's definitely a space that they want to play more in. And
so what is a preferred retailer going to get as part of this package?
So a preferred retailer gets demo units. Cool. And promo units and a bunch of, kind of one-off stuff that will only be available for the friendly local gaming store.
And giving retailers some exclusives is something that kind of needs to happen if we want to preserve that space for people to game in.
Oh, so, without a doubt.
Yeah, so definitely go check out your local game store, get some demos done, buy your products there if you can. So.
Yeah, IDW's got some really neat stuff coming out, too. I'm really looking forward to the Ninja Turtles game because I'm a big Kevin Wilson fan. He, of course, did Descent. That is such a great game. Take the basic Descent model and then make it a Ninja Turtle game. Sign me up.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the archetypical dungeon crawler, and now you're going to get to...
Now it's the sewer crawler.
Yeah. Go around and chop up some foot soldiers.
Yeah, let's hope it's not as Nintendo hard as that one game. Oh my God.
The original Nintendo game?
Nobody ever beat that.
I think we all still have bruised egos from that one.
Okay, so now Robert and I get to talk about our fun stuff. WotC has done a ton of announcements. They did announce Eldritch Moon. Eldritch Moon's been announced for a while, but they kind of started to spoil cards. So spoilers for that are starting to come out. So Magic people are starting to get hype. Pre-release.
Magic people getting hype? Surely not.
Yeah, hey man, it's what we do.
But they spoiled Emrakul, and Emrakul is my jam.
Emrakul, yeah,
I love the Emrakul.
She is weird now. It's a very weird card. It does weird stuff for the game. And they also spoiled a werewolf legendary creature, which is something that has not existed before. Werewolves are a tribe in the Innistrad setting of Magic the Gathering. They've kind of been in a wonky spot where like everybody really loves their flavor, but mechanically they're very difficult to pull off in decks. Printing a legendary one who actually looks very good means that you might get to see some werewolf commander decks, which will be super fun for the Magic community. So that's just a little neat aside about Magic. Now we talk about D&D.
So WotC has announced the newest D&D story, Storm King's Thunder. It's going to focus on giants and the lack of the Storm King to be able to keep all the other giant tribes in check. And they are going to... They did a prestige class, the Runic Magic class. It sounds like it's going to get printed.
Yeah, this was one of the first Unearthed Arcanas they released for 5th edition. It was like, hey, we're going to reintroduce the concept of prestige classes. And everyone was like, oh, neat. And they showed this Rune Mage, and they kind of didn't talk about it again for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of seems like they're finally coming back around to that concept.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to get to play around in the design space if we're actually going to have a published prestige class, so we kind of know what those are supposed to look like for 5th edition. There's also been some talk of actually being able to turn your characters into giants and or play as giants.
Yes.
Which, how rad is that?
Yeah. That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the big question that I've been trying to figure out in my head is this a reboot of the Against the Giants series, or is this going to be its own thing?
You'd think that. Thematically, it doesn't seem to have a lot in common.
But they keep using words from the old titles, you know, like
Jarls are the chiefs of the giants. Like that's just
in the blurb from the Italian site they had Steeding too, which is the Steeding of the Hill Giant Chief. So I don't know. I mean, we'll find out.
They've been doing this revisiting older themes in some of the previous storybooks. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The Curse of Strahd is a reboot or redux of Castle Ravenloft, and then the Princess of the Apocalypse was a reboot of the Temple of Elemental Evil.
And see, I think that Princess of the Apocalypse is a better thing to look at than Curse of Strahd, because Curse of Strahd preserves completely like a lot of the original setting and flavor.
Yeah, most of the new content is from before you enter the castle.
Right, and so in this particular case, they're maybe drawing a little bit on Against the Giants for inspiration, but what this is it's much closer to what
Princes of the Apocalypse.
This is much closer to what Princes of the Apocalypse was to Temple of Elemental Evil, because Temple of Elemental Evil was a Greyhawk module. This one is going to be in, you know, and then Princes of the Apocalypse moved it to Forgotten Realms, you know, so it was a spiritual successor, but it's not really a sequel. But it looks super fun. Giants are probably one of the coolest, like, monsters in D&D. You know, you have hill giants, fire giants, stone giants, cloud giants, storm giants. They all have neat powers and do neat stuff, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So, and that comes out August
26th at the Advanced Level stores, or September 6th everywhere else.
Now, Dungeons & Dragons is also getting its first rules expansion for 5th edition, right?
Yes, Volo's Guide to Monsters is coming out, and it is said to have 100 new monsters in it, rules to play goblins, orcs, and Firbolg giants.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. And then they're going
to
have expanded fluff on some of their iconic monsters to put some of the, you know, they've had a lot of fluff creep about, like, mind flayers and all that.
Yeah, they called out beholders, mind flayers. They're also bringing back the Neogi.
Think of an eel with spider legs.
Ooh, yeah. Love it. Please?
And they enslave people and are way into being slavers. Yeah, they're bad. They're bad dudes. And
Volo's not a new character, right?
No, Volo's from second edition. He got his start. Ed Greenwood uses him to write, like, travel logs. Mm-hmm. So he did a series of books called, like, Volo's Guide to the Dales and Volo's Guide to the Sword Coast. And it's like a travel book. It's like, oh, I want to go to this city. What's a good place to get some fine dining while I'm in Cormyr?
It seems like a missed opportunity, because they had the Sword Coast book.
They honestly should have used Volo for that.
Well, actually, the DM's Guild, Ed Greenwood is going to write for the DM's Guild and do Volo's Guide to Blah and kind of do that in the DM's Guild.
So. That's good.
Also, one thing that's kind of interesting for me from my sort of, you know, content creator, rules lawyer side, this is what I would consider to be, like, the first true splat book for D&D 5th edition, because you're at 100 monsters is a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It's a lot of new, like, design space to play around in, at least 3 new player character races.
I like the Sword Coast book a lot, but I thought it was severely lacking in terms of expansion.
It was a little bit anemic, yeah.
Yeah, it was great fluff, don't get me wrong, and for
but a lot of the fluff was stuff we'd seen before.
True. And that I think that was part of my disappointment. I mean, it's essential kit for somebody who's trying to DM a session that's going to take place in that area, because it's so chock full of good ideas.
Well, especially if you don't own older 5th edition.
Exactly.
Because that was the thing about Sword Coast Guide. It's like, if you already had a 5th edition, like, if you already had, like,
The 3rd edition Forgotten Realms book is amazing.
The system agnostic setting book.
Elminster's Guide to the Realms?
Elminster's Guide to the Realms.
That one's insanely crazy.
Yeah. If you already had a lot of that stuff, Sword Coast did not give you a whole lot more, except for the class stuff, which is literally just like a 20-page insert at the end of the book. This one is going to be just, like, tons of content. So
it's worth it for the monsters alone. 100 monsters, that's a lot of monsters.
The fluff is going to be really cool. Like, the fluff they've done for beholders and stuff, there's a lot there from the history of D&D, it'll be fun to read.
I'm looking forward to this one. This one looks like it comes out on November 4th to Advanced Level stores, and then, of course, about 2 weeks later, November 15th for everyone else.
And now let's cast our gaze towards crowdfunding for a moment. Again, this is another one of those segments that we are going to give you an abbreviated version of, just so you get an idea of what we're going for. So let's take a look at a couple of big projects out right now, one of which almost immediately was at $1 million, less than a day to hit $1 million. It funded in 4 minutes.
You know what? I'm not impressed. It's like BioWare games are written good. They Cool Mini or Not doesn't get credit for that anymore.
So, spoiler, we're talking about a Cool Mini.
Yeah. Sorry, spoiler alert.
So this is Massive Darkness, and from a board game perspective, this is the game that it's like they're placing it in my lap and saying, here, this was for you because we love you and you've spent money with us before. So let's talk about the game for a moment. So the game is Massive Darkness, and this is a new game. It's using the Zombicide engine at its core, but it's taking it in a very different direction. It's a 1-6 player, fully cooperative game. You're playing against the deck. And what's really interesting about this one is that you have the characters and they have base abilities, and that's listed on one card. And then you have experience tracks
Basically like kind of like specializations,
exactly,
or class paths.
But you don't have to match them. You can mix and match. So you can have a giant barbarian who also happens to be on the wizard track, and that's kind of neat.
I missed that when my first read.
Yeah, it's completely mix and match. That's why they've kept them apart from each other. Hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I like the fact that it's co-op. That's always good.
Yeah, well, and I only checked it out briefly, but I mean, I saw some of the artwork. It has like very much of like a little bit of an old school sort of Frank Frazetta-ish vibe to a lot of it. We know that their stuff is going to be pretty high quality, so I imagine it should be a lot of fun. I mean, a
lot of really nice stretch goals so far.
They don't make bad games. It's just not a thing they do.
You know, say what you will about the model that they're using crowdfunding basically as a pre-order scheme. The people that do put their money into the Cool Mini or Not Kickstarters, they do get a return on that investment because the stretch goals that they provide are off the charts.
Yeah, they give you a bunch of stuff. Yeah. As demonstrated by your big old box right over there.
Oh, yeah, the Zombicide box, the ridiculous Zombicide box. Yeah, without a doubt. And then this one's going to be another one that's just like it. Just about halfway through their run on Kickstarter, they're sitting at $1.7 million with over 50 stretch goals unlocked, which is amazing. So it's almost doubling the count of figures that come in the box.
I like this figure of this I guess he's a Cyclops. Because he's got giant boulder he's about to smash someone with. And dude is quality Cyclops here. He sharpened that boulder into a point to give you extra death. Because just smashing it with a giant boulder would not be enough. He has to impale you on it.
It's almost like he's... It's more of a stabbing at that. It's like a stab smashing, a smabbing, if you will.
You know what? The commitment to quality. I got to give it some credit.
In terms of backing levels, there's only one backing level. It's $120 to get in on the Kickstarter. It comes with the base game, the player holders... I believe it's 6 heroes in the core set, and all the cards and all the enemies that you need to power through it. But with the Kickstarter being the way it is, you're well over probably $300 worth of material at this point. Additionally, they're going to have an add-on, and I believe it's $8. Don't quote me on that, but I believe that's what they said. And this add-on will let you hot swap all of your characters from Zombicide Black Plague into this game, and vice versa.
Basically like a conversion kit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of awesome because then you get all those Zombicide Black Plague heroes and all their abilities in Massive Darkness, and then you can take all these Massive Darkness heroes and drop them into Black Plague.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of what Days of Wonder did with Small World and Small World Underground, where they did release it as a separate game, but then they just had a little kit you could get that said, like, hey, you can play these two games together.
Yeah. So. Well, and you know what? $8? It almost seems like a given. I mean,
it's pretty reasonable. If you already own Zombicide Black Plague, there's pretty much no reason not to.
And it gives you so much more replayability with both games. Which is really awesome.
All right, so we got another one, Kuro Realms.
Yes,
from the makers of Star Realms.
So it's from White Wizard. I mean, I'm a huge Star Realms fan, so I back this almost instantly. Yeah.
No, you like Star Realms?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Just a little bit?
I mean, you know, 3 to 5 games a day. Just a smidge.
So this one is not really like that, though. This is not quite the super fast pick-up-and-play game.
No, Realms. By design. Yeah, so they basically took the Star Realms engine and they started doing tweaks. This is not like Cthulhu Realms, where they took the Star Realms engine and basically put a fresh...
They reskinned it, kind of, yeah.
Instead, they've made this so that it can be a cooperative versus AI card game. And they've actually got a lot of RPG elements in it, too, so that basically bringing in a specific character deck, and you can purchase additional character decks for expansion. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the backing levels allows you to get, I believe, 6 to 8 new character decks right off the bat, which is...
See, this is stuff I like to see, because I like deck builders, but the problem is a lot of them get very samey for me, and it's like, why am I playing this? I could just play Dominion.
Yeah, and honestly, that's something I could say about Star Realms. I play it now out of habit, but it's, you know, I know exactly what to expect. I know exactly how to manipulate the cards. Something like this gives it a lot more depth.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I just love co-op games like that. Like, I haven't played one, I'm so jelly, like you guys played the Pathfinder card game, and really, I really want to get into
one earlier of those. You were comparing it favorably, and it does seem like it has a lot in common with the Pathfinder adventure card game, which I played, I think I've played...
You played both barrels of that, right? Like, Rune Lords and...
All three. I played the Rise of the Rune Lords, the pirate one,
Skull and Shackles.
Skull and Shackles. I just played through those three. The third one has come out, but I don't. We took a break and we did not pick that one up. But yeah, I played through every single scenario of those because the Pathfinder Adventure Card Game is great. And it's, if you know, this seems like kind of the same thing, and it seems like it'll actually be a little bit less cumbersome and a little bit less setup heavy than the Pathfinder card game.
Yes, which is considerably nice. Less.
Yeah, so it will be still faster to play than a lot of similar kind of RPG light dungeon crawler yeah. type things.
Well, and there is an experience aspect to it too, yeah. because you do collect XP for the foes that you kill and whatnot. And now a neat thing about it is they do have rules variants in there that take it from the co-op and make it adversarial, so you can play it kind of similar to Star Realms or Cthulhu Realms, which is kind of neat. A little, you know, added gameplay there for your yeah. money.
So what kind of backer levels do they have for this one?
So honestly, this is epic. The base level game, much like Star Realms, much like Epic Card Game, it's $20. $20 gets you the game.
Nice.
And in terms of replayability, I mean, I would be hard pressed to find a game that has given me more bang for my $20 than Star Realms has.
Yeah, agreed. I played that a lot with my wife. And that's the beauty of that game, too. I played a lot yeah. with my wife, and we can just crank one out, you know, and it's like, oh, hey, you know, we got some time to kill. Let's just play some Star yeah. Realms.
It's quick to set up. It's got a fair amount of gameplay depth, and you get it for $20, which is unheard of, you know?
Now, this one's going to have a little bit more expandability, though, because you were mentioning their character deck.
So $25 gets you the core game, and it gets you 12 Year One promo cards, which mm-hmm. modify. And then $45 gets you the first of the character tiers. That's the base game, and then you get 5 character packs. And then, of course, there's a $72 version, and that version gets you 5 character packs, the base game, 2 boss decks, which are completely, you know, the core game comes with a boss deck, and then the additional boss decks give you, it's almost like a different quest to go
on. It's basically like an extra adventure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you get the campaign starter deck, allowing you to take the card game and run a more long-term campaign off of it, which is really neat.
Well, that seems like that's where it really starts to hit like what the Pathfinder Adventure card game is trying to be.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you know, suddenly we're looking at these higher prices, but when you consider that the Pathfinder Adventure Card Game, the core game, without all the frills and all the bells and whistles, is 60?
It's about $60, yeah.
Yeah.
In a giant box.
And, so, and each of the adventures that comes out for that runs about $20.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So now you're talking about $72. That's for everything they're producing. Yeah. That's, you know, additional characters. That's additional adventures, additional bosses.
Yeah, and if it does well, I mean, it's just really easy for them to crank out something
And it has done very well. It funded on the first day as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that's great about games like this, even though the initial investment might be kind of around the same price as like your average board game, when they do put out those mini expansions later, and they can just keep putting them out forever as long as they feel like it, it's very easy to go pick up one of these little decks and add a whole new dimension to your game, significantly cheaper and easier than picking up, say, a board game expansion or something like Imperial yep. Assault, where you have the kind of expensive miniatures that you have to
constantly. Or to go particularly old school, you can have Fremenies of Catan, which I think is $5. Or you can get, like, you know, Seafarers, which is the
which
price
is
of
like
the box.
Another $50. Yeah. Yeah. These little decks give you a lot of, like I said, a lot of flexibility in how they can continue to expand the product line.
Well, so I remember when you guys were playing it, like, you guys would pick one up as they came out. Like, you guys were playing it sort of in real time, which was yeah. kind of fun to watch.
But what I'm saying is that this product has the potential to have a lot of longevity. So the gist of it is, this is a good one to get on the ground floor of, basically.
Yeah, without a doubt. Especially at these prices. And, you know, it's kind of interesting when you look at the statistics of the backers. Only 9 people have backed the base $20 game. 388 people have backed the base game plus the year one promos. 270 people have gone to the $45 route. 2,500 people have jumped on the maximum $72 level that gets you everything. Obviously, you can see the value there.
Well, and again, like, and when you think about it again, like, $72 for a Kickstarter game is not that hefty of an investment.
No,
I mean,
it's in line with everything else that yeah. we've seen. So that's, again, just a little bit of the taste of what to expect with their crowdfunding coverage. I'll go with coverage.
Crowdfunding coverage sounds good. I like it.
And now it's time for our very first review. And it wouldn't seem right to not start with Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition.
No, that's, it wouldn't. That's how we got founded.
Yeah, that's what our whole site started out.
Exactly.
5th ed. So, 5th ed D&D's been out for a while. This is obviously not a new product. But that does mean we have the advantage of having played it a lot. So
a
Robert and I have a lot to say about this one. So let's go ahead and...
Just to give us some nerd cred on where we're coming from here, we ran the Shackled City game, which I wrote an article about. That took us... We went from level 1 to level 22?
Yeah, well, the equivalent of level 22. Also, Robert and I and Robert's wife and a couple friends of ours played in the alpha playtest of this edition and one of the betas as well.
So yeah,
we've been playing this even longer than a lot of people who are playing it now.
Yeah.
So I've got about a 6-month-old campaign that I've been GMing. So
yeah, we have all been around the block with 5th Ed a few times. So.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go ahead and talk about first impressions of the game. So 5th Edition came out in 2014.
Yep. And it replaces the much
reviled 4th Edition. I actually did not hate 4th, but a lot of people did. We don't need to talk about 4th, though.
Please, no.
All right, let's get started with some first impressions.
First thing, Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro do pretty good work. The book quality is decent. You're going to notice awesome artwork, great cover art on all of the books so far.
Yeah, this one, bad cover.
Well, this one in particular has been throwbacks, because like the DM's guide has Vecna on it. The Player's Handbook is a direct reference to Against the Giants trilogy.
It's actually Surtur is the character on the cover of the Player's Handbook who's a fire giant villain from one of the old adventures.
Yeah, like if you know the lore of the stuff, like all of this stuff is direct references to older products, and I think they were going after that. Like they were trying to get the old players back.
And one of the things, the D&D line has always consisted of three core books. You have a Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, and a Monster Manual, which, if you're used to more modern RPGs, that might seem a little archaic to you. You're used to everything being in one book.
Well, and you know what? I understand that they were trying to be true to their line, but to me, that was a huge miss.
See, I am fine with it only because in these particular books, the amount and quality of content kind of justifies splitting them up, in my opinion. Also, one thing to note, too, is that they are $50 a pop. Most competing RPGs are going to be more in the 60 to 70 range. So it's like, yeah, you got to buy three books, but they're slightly cheaper and you get a lot of bang for your buck. The Player's Handbook has a ton of class options. The Monster Manual has a ton of monsters. The DMG has a ton of magic items and optional systems and stuff. There's just a lot of, because they have years of experience to build on.
And let's face it, like when you look through the Monster Manual, when you look through the Player Manual, you're dealing with a lot of the existing Dungeons and Dragons critters and tropes and whatnot. So like you said, they're pulling from a pretty diverse history, but
they were trying to get the old school grognards back because 4th edition shed a lot of their consumer base, and they're obviously trying to get them back. I mean, I know the old school Renaissance movement. A lot of them have just adopted 5th edition. They're like, yeah, that's fine. Like that's just fine.
This is very much designed to appeal to fans of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd edition D&D.
Yes.
And it's
with the bone to 4th because of the warlocks.
Yeah, they kept some of the rules refinements that 4th edition had, because rules were like 4th edition had some very good changes to the rules. Mm-hmm. It had a good skill system, which none of the previous editions of D&D had ever had before. You know, it had some neat concepts for making non-spellcasters that kind of have some cool powers, too. And they kept a little bit of that in this. You know, this draws from all of D&D's history, and, you know, splitting the main books into the three product lines is part of that.
My favorite little nuance to this is they have, like, quotes. Like, you know, in most role-playing games, they'll open up with a quote randomly. All of the quotes are from their novels.
And I would say that 5th edition, like, the first impression it left with me, it's very respectful of the games that came before it.
Indeed.
There is a pro to the three book system. If you're just a player and you're not a GM, then you only need the player handbook, and that's huge because it makes your life a lot easier.
Yeah,
it's very true.
Small condensed, you know, a rule set that only applies to what you're doing. But on the flip side of that coin, when you're GMing this thing and you're trying to figure out where in the three volumes, you know, some obscure rule lies, or you're trying to figure out, okay, is this monster in the Monster Manual, or is this monster in the adventure book that I'm in, or is this monster in, you know, does it happen to be in the Player's Manual because it gets referenced in a weird way? it's extremely frustrating, especially because they didn't release any kind of collated index that covers all of the manuals.
That is true. Now, one thing I will say, though, is that WotC is very good about at least putting a good alphabetized index in the back of each book, which not all RPG companies do.
And it can be really
although the Player's Handbook index is a little...
It's a little sketch.
Yeah. It's a little,
The Player's Handbook index leaves a lot to be desired, but at least it has one, like you said.
Yeah.
But the index in the Dungeon Master's Guide, I found to be very, very good.
Yeah, they got much better
in the
second one.
Really, I can't help but to wish that... Heck, I even would have paid a couple bucks for it, you know, just like a unified index handout.
Now, there just to let you know, there are a bunch of fan-made ones online.
Of course, one of the
things that is great about this edition, which we'll get into a little bit later, is that WotC has been very good about supporting the online community with this. And another thing that I'm going to bring up while we're just talking about the actual books themselves as physical objects... The covers are great, as mentioned. The artwork is very good in all of them, as mentioned. The pages themselves are...
They're very thin.
They're very thin, but it's decent quality paper. However, there is a binding issue with some of the early runs of the book. And that's a known issue. Like, people know that it happened. If you have one of the books that was printed in...
In the first run. Happened to yours, right?
Even the second one. Yeah, it happened to two of mine. I've had three copies of the Player's Handbook now, and two of them have had this problem. Basically, the binding, the glue breaks and comes undone and pages fall out. Now, one thing that's good about this, this might be informative to some listeners, Wizards does actually have a procedure in place to get your book replaced if it had this issue. It's on their website, and essentially, if you can prove that you bought the book within the last 6 months, I believe...
And yeah.
Provide a receipt from the store you bought it, they will give you a new one. You just have to wait for it to show up in the mail. Let's get into the meat and potatoes now.
Thematics. Let's talk thematics here.
We kind of touched on this already, that thematically this game is awesome. It is pretty much everything that... every impression you have of D&D from pop culture. So every reference you've seen to it in a TV show, every reference you've heard about it from celebrities talking about playing it, every memory you have of playing it as a kid, this is that game. It hits all of the notes you want it to hit. It is the D&D that everybody wants when they think of D&D.
I think the best addition to it was the background system.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
Yeah. In my game, when we were running it, it became very clear that that you guys were not playing to your alignment like is kind of traditional for D&D. You guys were much more playing to your backgrounds, which I thought was freaking brilliant.
Yeah, well, that's getting more into specifics, but yeah, like, overall, this game just hits on a lot of levels. Like creating characters in it is a very fun experience. It's not difficult. Like, one of my favorite stories about this game, which I'll tell real quick. By the way, I have a lot to say about this game, so I apologize if I'm hogging the mic a little bit. One of my favorite stories about this game, I have a friend. She had never played a role-playing game before in her life. She was familiar with the concept, and she'd wanted to try it, never had had a chance. So I took her with me to a night up at the shop where I was running a game. She sat down, looked through the book, and I said, "What kind of character sounds cool to you?" And she's like, "Oh, I want to be a gnome. Gnomes are rad." And I'm like, "All right, yeah, gnomes are rad." And she's like, "I want to be a ranger. I want to be like a woodsy guy." And so she started writing stuff down. I didn't need to talk her through much of it at all. She just, like, found the stuff in the book and started writing it down on her character sheet. She'd created herself a gnome ranger in, like, probably, like, 30 minutes. You know, which, 30 minutes to make your first character ever, never having played a role-playing game before, is insanely fast.
It's a very streamlined creation system that's smartly laid out. And it progresses through the different steps of character creation in such a way that... it never gets in its own way. And I think that was a big problem with previous editions of Dungeons & Dragons, is that occasionally, especially during character creation, the system would get in its own way.
Yeah, like especially like 3.5, it's like you would hit that point, you know, where it's like, okay, now it's time to assign your skill points, and everybody would like sag their shoulders and go, oh god.
And that should be a fun and exciting portion of it. I mean, you're rounding out your character, you're getting skills that you're going to be able to apply in the adventure. That should be the most fun you have.
Yeah, but instead it became this like exercise in like, okay, I have cross class and class skills, and these cost this many points, and these cost this one. It's like, are you proficient? Yes or no? Check a box. Bam. Done. And all of the skills do exactly what you think they do. So, do you need to persuade people? Pick persuasion.
Yeah.
do you need to deceive people? Pick deception.
Do you want to know about religious stuff?
Pick religion. Yeah, like it's very intuitive.
I think it speaks to what we were talking about earlier. It's a continued example of that refinement that they were so laser focused on. Everything is streamlined, everything is refined. And what I think that leads to, especially the history system that you were talking about earlier, I think that that's this major push to have the narrative be in the forefront, not the chunky rule system.
Yeah, well, and Rob was talking about backgrounds, and we're both a huge fan of the background system, and I'll let you expand on that a little bit, but, like, D&D, you know, used to have this kind of idea of, like, your character was not really three-dimensional. They were, because it has its roots in war games, you know, where your character is literally just an assemblage of mechanical things to kill
goblins. As we popularly call it, a murder hobo.
Yeah, you're a murder hobo who kicks in doors, kills monsters, takes their stuff. This one is much more steeped in the high fantasy genre that it's meant to emulate. And so your characters have a story and have real character to them.
And it's just what I love about the background system. Like, when I realized that you guys were playing to that, and it wasn't just the collection of alignment and, you know, it's like, I'm an elf who's good. You know, it was like, I'm a charlatan, I'm a hermit, like, you know, and all of you guys really got into that.
It really captures the player's imagination, because my group, much the same way, they got wrapped up in that background, to the point where they spent an entire two-hour session just discussing how they met and how they came to be on the adventure and what their relationships were.
Yeah.
Well, and also it leads to interesting choices, too, because, like, when you're role-playing your character through a campaign, you know, like, how you act when you meet an NPC, you know, like, you have so much more to go on.
Yeah.
And also, the other thing that's interesting about it, too, is you can either kind of go bottom-up, where you approach it from going through the character creation thing they lay out, or it's very easy. If you have a concept in mind, if you already have an archetype you want to play to, it's very easy to build it out of the pieces they give you.
Yeah. For a GM, this, you know, background system and the creation of the character's history is a gold mine. I mean, it's basically like, when I GM my game, I keep a copy of everybody's character sheet there. And part of my character creation is I add the step of everybody has to have a deep, dark secret that nobody else knows, because it's yet another hook that I can use to manipulate the characters. Between the history and the secrets, like, I was never wanting for a way to motivate people to do things. That's something that I've come across in other systems, where I've found myself in a bad spot where I can't advance things, and I can't get the characters to do what I want because I don't know enough about them to trigger their behavior.
Yeah, it's so much easier to get stories with beyond, because, you know, the way that it was typically you motivated characters in D&D was like, hey, there's money and treasure. You know, this goes so much beyond that.
Oh, and XP. I remember back in second edition days, people figuring out, it's like, how much of an orc genocide do I have to do to get to level 19?
Yeah. or like people that needed like 5 XP to level up, and they'd be on their lawful good paladin, and they'd just like sneak off and kill a peasant because it gave them the 5 XP.
or
I've heard that story, like, that exact story.
So let's transition now from character creation into actual gameplay.
Mechanically, gameplay in this edition is going to feel very similar to older ones. Everything's based on a d20 roll. So roll a d20, add your bonuses, try to beat a number.
Yeah, it's the basic system of third.
It's the same mechanics that every edition of D&D has used, pretty much.
But what it doesn't borrow from 3rd, and this I think is a huge win, especially having played Pathfinder, is all the crunchiness.
Yeah.
They've ironed all that away and basically...
Oh, yeah, like the floating modifiers everywhere.
There is a lot of crunch, but yeah, it's not fiddly.
No, and not at all.
They added a very elegant system called advantage and disadvantage, which I think has been... Everybody loves it, pretty much.
There's, yeah. Well, it makes life easy. It's like, oh, should you have advantage? Roll 2d20, take the best. Should you have disadvantage? Roll 2d20, take the worst. It's so simple. And instead of having just floating randomness out there, it's like, oh, well, you get +2 because, you know, of your cross, this other skill gives you a +2. But I'm going to give you a -3 because it's a wet wall that you're trying to climb up. And it's just, no.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah, yeah. There are still some conditional +1s and +2s you got to remember here and there. But overall... knowing what number you need to add to your roll is way easy.
Yeah. Those kind of aspects are the exception. They're certainly not the rule.
Yeah. And so mechanically, it's very simple, very elegant, very streamlined. Combat is
fast.
Yeah, very easy to figure out.
I remember our first 4th edition combat took us like over an hour, and our first one here was like 10 minutes
now,
max.
To be fair, it is not as fast as some other RPGs, nor is it as narrative as others. It is very tactical still.
Yes.
You still will find yourself wanting miniatures a lot. You will still want to draw out the battlefields because distance matters, movement matters.
This is definitely a system where it's obvious that the distances and the miniatures were the core focus.
Yeah.
And that's where it works at its best.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that you can't play it in the abstract, because my group has, but we've had the most success and we've had the best experiences playing with a map with a grid or a square grid on it and minis.
Well, and I would say in your game, Rob, we kind of did it ad hoc. Like, we would kind of mix and match.
So. Yeah, it depended. It depended on what was going on. Typically, it was like the fights that mattered more. If it was more important to the storyline that this really feel, you know, like a boss battle or something. But sometimes it was just like, random thing is happening here, just whatever.
Yeah, well, and that's how most DMs always did D&D anyway. But yeah, like, you can kind of switch between Theater of the Mind and using miniatures. But if you really want to get the most out of what's on your character sheet, especially certain spells and certain abilities that really care about area and movement... you'll want to use miniatures, but it's not nearly as fiddly as, say, like 4th edition was, where if a miniature moved too far to one side or something, it would actually screw up the plans of the other player. This one's much more, a little bit more forgiving and a little bit less, like, strictly grid-based than some of the previous ones. It's very similar to 3rd edition in that respect.
So let's now kind of rotate away from basic gameplay, and let's talk a little bit about balance, because this is, I think, where all of us started to see some issues.
Yeah, so I talk about this a lot in an article on the site called Campaign Postmortem, Shackled City in D&D 5th Edition, but north of level 10, the game starts to break. Specifically, I noticed that things that were listed as boss encounters and, you know, where I'd throw like a dragon at people that was, you know, 4 or 5 levels higher than you in challenge, the party could, in theory, deal with in about a round and a half. And that got frustrating when I wanted things to feel threatening. You know, it's like, oh, this guy's really scary. He's really scary. And he's dead.
Yeah. And it's gone.
It's gone.
Yeah,
this game definitely has, especially with certain classes, and the wizard comes to mind, you get to god mode very quickly.
Well, and actually, in this particular edition, the fighter even scales pretty well at cranking out damage.
Yeah.
All of the characters, with a few exceptions, can really, you know, if they build for combat, they're gonna kill stuff real fast.
Yeah.
And by the end of the campaign, I was putting 300-400 extra hit points on things just to drag out the fight. So, you know, because otherwise I'd have to run all these little encounters to just try to drag down your resources. So by the time you got to the boss, you'd actually have to like work for it. Well, and that just wasn't fun.
That's a really good point to bring up, right? Because at the end of the day, it is the GM's responsibility to make it a challenge for the players, and the system does have the options available to it to do that. I mean, even if it's something as basic as just adding XP or you know, creating a situation where you're breaking some crucial piece of their gear or whatnot. It's,
yeah. Well, and one thing too is that if you look at the Monster Manual and DMG, the game designers obviously intended to balance encounters by adding what Rob, by doing what Rob was talking about, we're adding lots of extra creatures to encounters, so you never should encounter, most of the time you shouldn't encounter a boss by itself. You should have a bunch of minions with him. Or to him, you have to do a bunch of little fights. The problem that runs into, though, is that a lot of times the minions are also jokes. They literally just exist as a speed bump to use up a couple of spell slots, and then the players want to get to the boss fight. And dramatically, from a storytelling perspective, that doesn't always work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the one adventure I really went out of my way to do that was the one near the end, and in the volcano.
We fought the, basically, like, you structured it kind of similarly to, like, a WoW dungeon, where we had waves of...
Yeah, and there were several bosses
that we had to fight.
Yeah, until you got to the super demon, yeah. And it just got really boring, because, like, you guys were just, like... It was, like, combat felt like a chore, and then by the time you got to the end, you guys were so battered and broken... That, you know, well,
my dwarf druid, whose name still eludes me for...
Anyway, yeah, you sacrificed yourself at the end of that just to, like, kind of get it done.
Yeah, well, it was a cool moment.
It was a cool moment, but
yeah, like...
But we could have just as easily had that cool moment with that same demon having significantly more hit points and just having that battle take a little bit longer instead of, you know, having to roll initiative 15 times.
Yeah, so that is just one thing to stay aware of. This game really is in the sweet spot from about level 1 to 10.
Yeah.
Which is why you notice most of the current adventures are going to that. Yeah. Like, Storm King is going to level 10.
This one doesn't have quite that many problems. Like, spells are a little bit toned down and... You know, like, a lot of, like, world-shattering stuff is kind of left as a story fiat. Like, it's basically up to the DM as to what the consequences are and things like that. So, things that should be plot-relevant are still plot-relevant, but they don't actually have, like, a written-out game effect of, like, you know, it does X, Y, Z. So, that's good. Like, that's actually a very good design change, is that they made much more of it up to the DM and the player to work out.
Yeah.
However... The stuff that is still mechanically, you know, written out and set in stone still requires a little bit of tweaking to work at high level. So if you are planning to do this for the long haul, or if you're the kind of people that like to do high level campaigns, just be aware of that.
So let's kind of move on a recommended player count here, because I've actually had up to a very large group and things started to get difficult.
So in my game, I had 5 players. And it seemed to work out okay. I was gunning for 4, but I ended up with 5. but that, honestly, that's probably where you should keep it. The game seems to be designed around the idea that you will have 4 or 5 players with maybe a maximum of 6.
Yeah. I would say not to exceed 6, because if you exceed 6, there's a couple different problems you start to run into. You have to scale every encounter in dramatic ways to make it function. The other aspect that I was running into is that setting and managing initiative and, you know, kind of handling combat becomes a humongous burden.
Yeah.
And it just, the game, just as streamlined as it is, you start to see the chunkiness of the rules at 6 players.
Yeah.
And anything beyond 6, the chunkiness then exceeds the system's ability to kind of roll with the punches. And the game... It's just too complex.
And just to be fair, this occurs in pretty much any RPG.
Without a doubt, that is a fair statement.
That is any RPG that goes beyond purely narrative combat is going to have some problems, because you kind of have to have an initiative system, and you end up with people just sitting around waiting for their turn, which causes them to goof off and get distracted, and it just slows the game down a lot.
I've seen large player counts handled better by other systems.
Yeah. And there are some DMs out there who love large player counts. Like, I know some people who are like, I like all of my games to have, like, 8 to 10 people in them. And I'm like, you're crazy.
But anything, right? Your mileage may vary depending on your play style.
I will note that the organized play for this game, the Adventurers Guild, sets a strict maximum at 7 players per DM.
Yeah.
Like, even the people who design it say, do not go above 7. It's a bad idea. And even then, like Jonathan was saying, and like Rob was saying, like, above 5 is very tough. Like, 6 and 7 really is tough. 5 is pretty much where you want it at. And if you think about it, the classic D&D party is kind of designed around that paradigm, too. You have your fighter, you have your rogue, your thief, you have your wizard, you have your cleric, and then you have your fifth wheel, which is typically your bard or your ranger or something, your hybrid class.
Yep, yep.
So, anything else to say about 5th edition D&D?
If you want to get started, I would very much recommend the starter set. It gives you everything you need to do to get a campaign up to the fifth level,
yeah,
including making your characters for you, so you don't have that part. And the characters that they have in there are very good. So,
and it's only $20.
It's $20, and it comes with dice. I mean, most dice sets are like,
and a very good adventure called Lost Mines of Phandelver, yeah, which I've played through twice now, once as a DM, once as a player, and it's good. It's a good adventure. Yep. Like
it's a better adventure than the first adventure book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that is one thing we should talk about. The product line for D&D does include a lot more than the core books. They have published a couple of like setting books. They have the supplements coming out that we just talked about. And they have done what they call...
stories.
Storyline campaigns. The first one that came out was Tyranny of Dragons, which had two books. It's the only one so far to have two books.
Mm-hmm.
Horde of the Dragon Queen and Rise of Tiamat.
And while I like that one, I would suggest skipping it, because they were obviously making that while the rules were still in flux. So there's a few references to rules that no longer exist.
There are also some very, very poorly balanced encounters.
Yes,
so, without a doubt. And again, you know, this is nothing that a GM can actively fix on the fly if they want to, but... if this is your first experience GMing something, and, you know, it was my first time with the system when I GM that module, and it was extremely frustrating from a GM standpoint at times.
Yeah. Yeah, Horde of the Dragon Queen, like I said, if you've played the game before, I don't think it's a bad campaign at all. Like
it's got its moments.
Yeah, it definitely has some very cool moments. But yeah, it's not good for your first go around. So maybe pass on that one. Try one of the other ones, like
Princess of the Apocalypse
or Out of the Abyss.
Out of the Abyss or Curse of Strahd.
Curse of Strahd is actually one that I would recommend. Curse of Strahd is excellent.
Yeah, Curse of Strahd's rad.
It is very good. And they even have a little supplemental product for that called the Taroka deck, which is it's basically a tarot deck.
And it's one of the big set pieces is you get your fortune read. And it's pretty cool because it gives the adventure replayability, because that fortune reading actually affects storyline stuff.
Yeah, it's basically awesome. like a procedural generation for the adventure.
Motivations and stuff slightly change, and it just gives you a reason to do it again. And that's from the original module. The original module did that too, yeah. And so people would play it like every Halloween, yeah, or something.
And they also have a lot of like cool supplemental products. They do have
Skag.
Well, they have Sword Coast Adventure Guide, which is the Forgotten Realms setting.
We call it Skag because it's the initials.
Yeah, and it has some additional player characters. Also, Gale Force 9. They've released some official spell cards, which if you are playing a spellcaster, are very handy.
Yes.
It's basically the spells out of the book, but printed out on cards, so you don't have to flip through 10 pages of book to find the spell that your character
has. And then if you want more than that, you can go on to the DMsGuild.com, and they have a ton of pay what you want, free, and very minimal cost, you know, basically fan-made expansions that people are selling. But there's some. I mean, it's like anything that's the cloud or the crowdsource. There are some gems, and there are. There's some gems.
But of course, if you want the absolute best in fan created 5th edition D&D content, you go to ForgotMyDice.com and
course.
You look at the articles written by Robert and myself.
And they are free.
All right, so let's get to the quintessential question, right? Because, you know, we're not going to assign a score here, so let's get to the core question behind any game, and that is it fun? So, Trevor, what do you think? Is Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition fun?
Well, it's hard for me to make a purely objective judgment, obviously. This is, in my opinion, it's the most fun I've had with an RPG in a long time. It's a very well-made game. It's D&D. It has all of the nostalgic quality that you want out of that brand. And yeah, it just, you know, it does exactly what you want it to do. You want to go trudging into a dungeon, dodging traps, finding treasure, kill a dragon at the end. This is the game to do it in. You know, if you want to do high concept stuff, you know, if you're more into narrative, maybe this is not for you. But if you want the quintessential role-playing game, you know, classic role-playing game experience, play D&D. It's great.
I like that you brought up the nostalgia, because the nostalgia is absolutely palpable through every corner of this game.
Yeah.
So how about you, Robert? What are your final thoughts?
I'll go on record. This is the best version of D&D they've ever made. Just straight up. Now, do other versions have more of X and more of Y and more of Z? Yes, other versions do. But, like, from a standpoint of just playability and just, you know, I will go back and play this. Like, yeah. Because usually when there's a version of D&D out, I usually play one long game of it, and then I'm kind of burned out on the whole idea until the next one comes out. But I would totally do 5th edition again. I took a break after Shackled City, but I've already looked at a few things, and I'm like, ooh, Curse of Strahd, ooh, the Storm King, those look fun. So, I would totally run it again. It's awesome.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think that this is, especially for the Dungeons & Dragons name, this is the pinnacle product. It's never been as good as it is. One aspect I really like about it is that it's accessible. It's accessible to a new player who's never played a role-playing game before, because it doesn't let the rules get in the way of the fun, and it gives plenty of opportunities for a player to just chuck one die and be able to engage fully with the game and the system, and they don't have all those little fiddly bits that were present in 3rd and 4th to kind of like take away from the play, from the player having fun, and take away from the player getting involved in the narrative and having to, you know, become a rules lawyer for a moment.
Yeah, but I will also just real quick to cap onto that, if you are like me and you are a little bit of a rules nerd, this game still has plenty of mechanical
without
depth.
A doubt. There's...
So yeah, do not mistake this for an overly simplified version of D&D. It is still very much a complex and deep game. So
I would say streamlined, yes. Simplistic, not at all.
No.
This is still a fully functional, fully featured role playing game with depth that you know nobody will ever fully explore.
And I'll add one last point. If you're thinking about playing and you want to go play it like an Adventurers League event, because you know you can't get a group together or whatever, and you're kind of worried about the idea that, oh, my character won't be up to snuff, I've literally seen this. I had a person join my table when all of my other characters were 4th level, and we told the character, you know, don't be a frontline person, like stay in the back and shoot things. So she had a bow, but that person contributed. They got the kill shots on a lot of stuff, actually, a surprising amount of things. And because the math and everything is condensed, the higher level characters were not significantly better than her. So, like, yeah, she was able to just jump in and play.
So I think it's safe to say that we all agree that this is, you know, the quintessential fantasy role-playing game.
Oh, it's the flagship product.
Yeah.
And you would be hard-pressed to do better on the market.
It's the bar. Like, you will be compared to this if you are doing anything remotely fantasy. It is the bar you will be judged by.
And that brings us to the conclusion of episode 0 of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Stay tuned for episode I Love Lamp.
So again, come September, we're going to be going into a bi-weekly schedule. Until then, please provide us with lots of feedback. Trevor, what are some of the ways that people can get in touch with us?
If you go to Forgot My Dice, when this gets posted, there will be Facebook comments. So if you're logged into Facebook, you can just comment right there and we'll see it. You can also comment on the post on our actual Facebook page, send us a message on Facebook, hit us up on Twitter at Forgot My Dice.
Can you comment on Pinterest?
You can also pin us on Pinterest.
You can pin us, that's for sure.
Pin us on Pinterest, Forgot My Dice.
So until you hear from us again, please do provide us with feedback. This is far from a finalized concept. We definitely want to evolve it and make it better. So let us know what you'd like to hear, what you liked, what you didn't like, what worked, what didn't work.
Other than that, just be excellent to each other.
Party on, dudes.
And good luck and good gaming.
Far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space.